Right, so a lot of people have been asking about Maslow's, right? What should I use? Should I go up? Should I go down? Stuff like that. So that's definitely what I will talk about, partly. But I also want to say, before I start with the tutorial about Maslow's rates, I want to sort of give a bit of a motivation of the kind of things I would be interested in learning in the next couple of weeks. And that is all to do with this Maslow's close to explosion. So we have the 2N supernovae, where there's clearly a lot of mass. But there's other indications of a lot of mass loss just before explosion, such as the supernova 2013 CU, where it has been possible to take a spectrum 15 hours after explosion, and what you see is all these emission lines. Actually, they have electron scattering wings, and then they have these narrow emission lines, and you see that throughout the spectrum, the optical spectrum, and these are very narrow, these lines. So in this discovery paper, it was argued, because you have all these emission lines, that it looks like a Bouverier, so that you're looking at the light from a Bouverier star, but these lines are all very narrow, so it's much more suggestive of an LBV, which has much slower winds. And another interesting aspect about that, you can derive the Maslow's rate from these kind of data, and they give you Maslow's rates of order 10 to the minus 3 solar mass per year. Now that is a high Maslow's rate for a normal star. Normal stars have Maslow's rates 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6 solar mass per year or so. Yeah.
Can you explain a bit how you derive the Maslow's rate and what uncertainties? It is
based on non-LTE modeling, basically on the. I will go more into this when I talk about winds, actually. Basically, the equivalent width of these lines gives you the density, and therefore you can get the Maslow's rate.
In the stationary approach, I suppose.
Yes.
So is there a geometry issue then?
Yeah, it's spherical. Yeah. Now, there's also, in this spectrum, there's a helium. These are helium lines, because there's no hydrogen, so these are helium 2 lines. But there's also a helium 1 line, so this is 6560 or so angstrom. There's a helium 1 line here, and you can only reproduce that if you include light travel time effects. And the point is that must have been formed over quite a large volume, and that means that there is a mass in this CSM of at least a total mass of at least 0.1 solar masses. Yeah. And if that has been going on for 100 years, that's a lot. But this could easily have gone on for more than 100 years. If this went on for 1,000 years, there could actually be solar mass of material there, which could have just that. What I'm trying to say is that if you see a solar mass of material around a supernova, that doesn't necessarily mean an eruption. And I think that is one of the things that I heard yesterday. A couple of times I heard the word LBV and then immediately eta car. And people immediately think LBV, oh, that means eta car, that means 10 solar masses within a decade. That is not necessarily always the case. And I think that's important to keep in mind. Can we understand these kind of mass loss rates with normal stellar winds? And I think we can. So that is basically what I want to work towards.
Can you remind us what supernova type that was?
This is a 2B.
You just said there was no hydrogen.
Sorry?
You just said there was no hydrogen.
There was little hydrogen. Yeah, so these lines are not really H-alpha, but more helium-2. Anyway, that is sort of introduction. So, talking about just your normal star winds, I think the first thing to define is the Eddington limit, G rad over G. And the G rad is basically the opacity times the flux over the speed of light times the Newtonian gravity. And because you can write the flux as L over 4 pi r squared, and also G as Gm over r squared, the r squared cancel. That's a nice thing about this, that you have a parameter That is basically just the L over M ratio, the star, times the opacity. Now that's the tricky bit. What is that opacity? Obviously, the opacity varies a lot through the atmosphere of a star. But for hot stars, the electron scattering opacity is very relevant. So you can just do this for the electron scattering gamma. In that case, this becomes like a stellar parameter. So the electron scattering gamma is basically a stellar parameter, just like L or M. So you always need to know two of them, either L or M or gamma, and then you know the third one. And that is a very relevant parameter when we get to very massive stars, because then the luminosity becomes very high because the mass becomes very high, and that is also when gamma becomes very high. And with very high, I mean like of order half, half the Eddington gamma or above. Now, in reality, of course, the real gamma is very different, and actually, this opacity can be much higher than the order of the electron scattering opacity. And Stan has already spoken about line-driven winds, where the opacity can be boosted by a factor of 1,000 because of the Doppler effects. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. Then, what did I have in mind for the second part? Okay. So maybe I should say something about the how we determine the real opacity. So when we don't look at just the electron scattering opacity, but we also look at the line opacity. If you have a star emitting photons, it hits atoms. In the simple case, let's just pick one scattering. Say you hit an iron atom, so you absorb it, and then you re-emit it. And because there's an equal chance of that and that, the only relevant point is that when you absorb it, you get an outward momentum, like that. So that is why, if that force or that acceleration is larger than gravity, you get an outflow. Now, in the old models, this was done in a single scattering case, but then people realized you can do this several times. You can emit photons, kick out an atom here, and in the most ideal case, you can use the same photon, travel to the other side of the star, and do it again. Yeah, so then you get H nu here, and then you get 2H nu here. Yeah. And then you keep doing that. Yeah. So that is the ideal case. But that won't happen in reality. The line lists are such that photons are intercepted earlier than that. But this still gives you a good idea about the kind of things you can get. But what happens in reality is more like you kick out a photon here, the atom, you give it a push here. The photon might travel back. You get a push there, in that case. But then, again, you get a push there, etc. And you kind of diffuse out, but every time you add some radial momentum. And that way, you still get a momentum in the wind, M dot V infinity, that can be larger than L over C. So the momentum of the star here can be larger than the momentum in the atoms, momentum per second. So that is quite neat that you can actually do that. And that relationship is going to be important later on. So basically, when people talk about eta, the wind efficiency number, they mean this number, M dot V infinity over L over C. So in multiple scattering cases like that, like for Wolf array stars, that can become larger than one. There's no fundamental physics violated here. I'm not saying that won't happen later. Anyway. So this is the calculation of the radiative acceleration, and then we have to put that into the equation of motion. We don't have to, but we can. And I'm just going to ignore the gas pressure in this equation, just to keep it simple, because it turns out this is the inertia term, gravity term, and the radiative term. This radiative term is much larger than the gas pressure. So for most of the wind, this one dominates. Now, for many years, people have characterized this relative acceleration as a function of the velocity gradient times some alpha parameter. So alpha is a parametrization of the line radiative acceleration. Some people say this is some sort of distribution of the optically thin and optically thick lines, and that is right. If you just look at the line statistics, you have a power law of lots of optically thin lines and fewer optically thick lines. But in the original CAK paper, this was just a fit to the line acceleration. So there is physical significance to this, but you don't have to parameterize it this way. You can also parameterize this in another way. You can do it as a function of the velocity or the radius or any function you want. And this is what we have done in more recent years, using these kind of Monte Carlo calculations and the radiative acceleration just as a function of radius. And if you do that, if you plug that in here, then you find a somewhat different critical point. If you fill this in, you get this nonlinear equation in dVdr, so you have a dVdr here and here, and what you find is a CAK critical point. If you put in something along these lines, and this does not mean that there's no physics included that depends on dVdr. That's still included. It just isn't in this parameterization. And in that case, you would have your sonic point as your critical point. But that is a whole discussion that I've been having with Stan over the last 10 years, and I'm not going to go there. So, in any case, these points are not too different anymore. In the old days, the CAK critical point was far out in the wind, but if you include the finite disk correction factor, it comes closer, and it comes very close to the sonic point. In any case, the point I want to make is there are different ways of parameterizing this radiative acceleration, and both have been used. And the CAK one is very nice because, so if you do it, this is the CAK way. This is Müller and Vink, 2008. But if you do the CAK way, then you get these nice scaling relations where the phi infinity of V escape is just the square root of alpha, 1 minus alpha. And because alpha is about 2/3, you get 1 minus 2/3, is 1/3, 2/3. So you get about the square root of 2. But if you then have correction factors, it becomes a bit larger. So the point is the terminal velocity of the wind becomes larger than the escape velocity. What do I mean with the terminal velocity? I just mean velocity as a function of radius. You start at 0, and you reach a certain terminal velocity. And the steepness of this is often described with a B-tunnel. Maybe also interesting to know for some people is that this phi infinity is actually very accurately known from observations. So if you have a spectrum in the UV, you have your P-Cygni lines, and from the edge velocity here, from this Doppler shift, you can derive phi infinity quite accurately, say within 10% or so. Yeah? It's very different for m dot, because the Maslow's rate depends on things like clumping and porosity. Now, from theory, for the CAK, the m dot can also be derived, because you can. There's a nice thing about plugging this in, that you can actually solve this equation without any free parameters. And except the CAK alpha and K parameters, but they may then be inferred from atomic physics. If you get this m dot from CAK, you go L 1 over alpha and the mass to the 1 minus 1 over alpha. Again, if you have L and m, that's one parameterization. You can, of course, also put it in terms of gamma e, and then you get a slightly different parameterization. But there's a reason why I do it this way, because I want to talk about the wind momentum and luminosity relation, and then it's more easy to see what happens if you use it this way. Now, this is some theory from CAK theory, and the kind of so this is your first approach. If you use this kind of approach with Monte Carlo, you can also get mass loss rates, but then it will be more of a fitting formula based on lots and lots of models where you take all the non-LTE effects into account, and then you can get mass loss rates that are a function of luminosity, mass, effective temperature, metallicity being the main ones. And the most used one is this recipe from 2000. So the luminosity goes here 2.2, and the mass goes minus 1.3. And if you put a mass-luminosity relation in, you get something very similar to CAK. But sometimes people say the mass, if the mass is higher, the mass loss rate is higher. That's actually not the case. When the mass is higher, the mass rate goes down. It's just because then the luminosity is higher, that wins. But in principle, the mass is an important parameter. And in many recipes that are used, like empirical recipes, you don't know the mass very well. And then this whole mass dependence is not taken into account in those recipes. So I don't think those recipes are particularly physical. Another point is the effective temperature dependence. There's a minus 1.3. That means that if you have a Hesse-Russell diagram, so luminosity, effective temperature, and you start with, say, a 60 solar mass star, and you evolve, if you don't rotate too much, you evolve redwoods. If you plot the mass loss rate, then you would actually, in principle, go down. But then there are certain changes in the ionization where it goes up again, and then it goes down. But the overall mass loss dependence is one that drops with temperature.
Excuse me. Eric, you've got a minus coefficient there.
Yeah.
So doesn't that imply that you go to lower temperature that you should?
Oh, I might have messed it up. Maybe that's more. I don't know. Someone can look it up, or I don't know. It's probably because temperature goes the wrong way. Yes. So the point is, the overall mass loss rate drops with lower temperature, but at certain temperatures you have a big increase because you have different ions driving the wind. So this part for the O stars is driven by ion 4, but here's by 3 and down by 2. And there's more opacity in the lower ionization stages than the higher ones, and that is why we get this increase. It's called bistability jobs. So that is why this. But the point I'm trying to make is the mass loss rate is not just a function of one of these parameters. It's a function of all of them. And therefore, it's important that you have a physical prescription of your mass loss rate that actually depends on these things. Because if you kick one out and you then start extrapolating, then you can go horribly wrong. And that sometimes happens. Okay.
Problem that there is an interdependence between those parameters. They're not really independent, like the mass and luminosity, and that's why people then say that increasing the mass loss rate should go up because the luminosity is even higher.
Yeah. Well, they're not independent, that's right. But the way I see it is that the mass loss rate is actually a function of the luminosity. It's the more radiation you have, the higher the mass loss rate. But this is more your potential well. This is the gravity you need to overcome, and the more massive, the higher the gravity, the larger the potential well, the more work you need to do to overcome that, and that is kind of taken into account in this parameter. So they are kind of physically both motivated quite well.
But from the zero age sequence, it means the mass loss rate climbs a lot because you're losing mass, and actually the luminosity is going up
because you
climb the main sequence. Not much, but the luminosity does go up. And so both of those factors work together. Drive the mass loss rate up with time.
Other questions so far? Yeah.
Maybe just to clarify a little bit more about the difference between the CAK legacy approach. I mean, it's not just CAK anymore, right?
been, you know, is that you just written it in proportionality to the luminosity and the mass.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the coefficients, the alpha and the proportionality, which is originally called K,
mm-hmm.
and then we characterize it in terms of this Q parameter, this Q bar parameter, that those are basically functions of the atomic physics that you solve for the non-LT equation.
Yes.
And one of the points I would like to make is that the Q parameter just basically says if you just make, it's like the it's the Planck opacity. If you were to make all the lines in the spectrum optically thin, then that's the radiation force you would get, how much stronger gravity it would be. But it doesn't really make any difference whether it doesn't make any difference whether the line's a very strong line or a weak line. And that's the total amount of writing you can get. But what happens with the alpha coefficient is it tunes between the optically thick and thin lines. Now, the point is if you change the level populations, the electrons that are in bound states and go to another bound state, if you change the ionization, for example, that parameter Q is probably not going to change very much. At least that's one conjecture. But what will happen is the distribution of opacity, you know, of how many more lines you have, will change. And so I really think the way to think about it is that the parameters that are here, the alpha actually changes as you change the ionization conditions. And if the alpha goes to smaller values, then the mass loss rate will go up by quite a lot.
Well,
and that comes from the fact that you're spreading the lines through more.
That is what happens.
Yeah.
When you go here in CAK terms, here you have an alpha of 2/3, and here you have an alpha of about 1/2.
Yeah.
So that is that change. And if you do that with the CAK, you can show that the mass loss rate, but if you change alpha from 2/3 to 1/2, the mass rate goes up by factor 30.
Yeah.
Something like that. But that's partly to do with this change in ionization.
Right.
But if you then do the CAK correctly, you need an extra term. I mean, this is all idealized, but then you need to introduce a delta as well for the ionization and so on. So it is a possibility, of course, to work with this and to add modifications like a finite disk correction factor and then a delta and then another maybe multiple scattering factor and so on. But ultimately, you have to do it numerically. That's what I'm trying to say. But I think the CAK is not it's very valuable because that's the basic framework we have. The reason I basically wrote this down in terms of L and M is to do with this wind momentum luminosity relation. So the key point, of course, is what I try to say is the phi infinity is quite accurate, but M dot can be highly inaccurate. So let's get to that. What do we mean by that?
Move from that.
Sorry?
Last equation.
This?
So what's the latest on the metallicity scaling as you go to a 10 solar, 100 solar?
This data hasn't changed. This is 0.7 or so.
But below some metallicity, it flattens out.
For Wolfram stars, I've done this M dot versus Z, where you have a sort of
steeper than 1/2.
It's steeper than 1/2. It's about 0.7, and then it flattens, but the metallicity where this happens is 10 to the minus 3, and that is in solar. So that is a thousandth of solar. So that is not really the observable universe.
Is that from observations? Or
no, this is theory. This is.
And that's just when the iron, there's not the electron scattering starts to dominate? Is that what's happening?
Sorry?
What's happening there? Is electron scattering starting
to. No, this. The reason why you get this is in the old days, the idea was that these winds are all driven by lines of CNO. Yeah? Because those are the strong lines in the UV spectra. Yeah? This could be carbon 4, 1550 angstrom, or something like that. And you see these strong lines. And people thought these are the lines that drive the wind. They're formed far out in the wind where you have a strong DVDR. So this CAK physics is very, very relevant. What we now have found already 20 years ago or so is that actually iron is very important. You have millions of lines. So if you have a hydrogen atom with just a few lines, right, you have your H alpha or so falling, whatever. If you look at CNO, it's quite simple like this. But if you have iron, then You have millions of lines. So the point is that the idea was that if this is a Wolfrier star brings first nitrogen, but then later carbon, and then the helium turns into carbon, brings that to the surface, and you get a strong CNO, mostly carbon-driven, wind. And if that scales with metallicity, you would expect the mass loss rate to be independent of the host galaxy metallicity. But actually, when I say Z here, I really should say iron. And it's really iron, not iron group, because iron is 10 times more abundant than nickel. So iron is the key here. And the reason iron wins from CNO is that it's much more complicated atomic physics. It's really the multiplication of the number of lines and the abundance. So in these kind of calculations, it's not just iron here. And iron is important, but this could be iron, and this could be carbon, now this could be silicon. These things are all included. Some of them are actually just electrons, or other continuum processes are included as well. But iron is the winner.
But for the plot, so why there is a plateau then?
So if you go, so that was where I was going for. The iron lines are all optically thin. They form very close to the surface. The CNO lines are optically thick, they form far out. But if you drop in metallicity, then at some point, these millions of iron lines, they really don't do anything anymore. Because they still need some optical depth to do something. And at some point, basically the iron loses out, and then indeed the CNO take over. And that's why this kind of old idea, it is still present, but at much lower metallicity.
Yeah. 0.7 exponent is observational.
No, this is theory.
Is that theory?
This is theory, yeah. This is both for O stars and for over A stars. So this is the 2000 paper. That means not O, but 0.0. And that is the 0.5 paper. Now, I will go to the observations in a moment. For the O stars, there's also empirical evidence for the 0.7. That's right. So theory and observations agree there, because we have observations there. For the Wolf-Rayet stars, we don't have that kind of data.
Yeah. There is the work from Reiner.
Yes, the problem there, we can come to that in a second. There's a huge spread in the mass loss rates with luminosity and so on. So there's clearly another parameter that's dominant in that paper. That's not the metallicity, mainly. So they find a steep dependence, like 1.2 or so. But there is a parameter missing in their parameterization, because otherwise you wouldn't have that huge spread by more order of magnitude. We can talk about that, but...
Maybe in response to Ed's question. So in CAK theory, the middle C dependence is based on this Q parameter that's basically proportional to metallicity. And then if you took the CAK formula that Zurich's written down, that appears basically be M over Q. And so it would be basically metallicity would scale with 1 over alpha minus 1. And if alpha is like 2/3, that comes up to about 0.7.
Okay, so let's go to the observation. So it is very hard to get mass loss rates from P-Cygni lines in the UV. The reason is the ionization is not well known, and there's additional problems to do with porosity, and that's something I will not talk about. But winds are clumped, and then they also become porous, and photons can escape through the clumps, both in spatial but also in velocity space. And that means that this is very hard to do from these lines. So what is mostly used is like H-alpha. So with the VLT, there's been two big surveys, the VLT flame survey and the VFTS, VLT flames tarantula survey. You get hundreds of spectra, optical spectra, and from H-alpha, you can get a handle on M-dot. So you get your emission lines, and basically from this equivalent width of the H-alpha line, To do this correctly, you also need to take into account this photospheric absorption and all kinds of other things. But basically, the equivalent width just scales with the density squared. So that is the mass loss rate over phi infinity squared. And the phi infinity you can get from the UV. So then you end up with a mass loss rate estimator. But there's a problem there, and we'll come to that. Now, the way people plot this, then, normally, is in the wind momentum and luminosity relation. And that is called D versus luminosity. So when you plot these mass loss rates with luminosity, you get something that is like a linear relation. And why is that? That has to do with... So let me first define D. The modified wind momentum is m dot phi infinity times the square root of the radius. This has been defined by Kudrytsky 20 years ago or so. And what you can see, why this is useful, is to do with those scalings of CAK. If you put the m dot CAK scaling in here, so you get your L 1 minus alpha, m 1 over alpha, and then the phi infinity is basically scaled with your escape speed, so that is gm over r. So you get an m to the half, and then divided by r to the half, times this modification factor. And there's a reason for that, because then this cancels. That's why this modified wind momentum was used by Kudrytsky. So then those cancel, and you get rid of this. So the nice thing now is that you can write the mass as 3 over 2 minus 1 over alpha. And because alpha is about 2/3 for O stars, this is 1 over 2/3, so that's 3 over 2. The mass cancels. So this is how you get rid of the mass. And then your luminosity just goes with L over 1.5. Yeah? So if you can measure mass loss rates from these kind of lines, and you plot the wind momentum, Kudrytsky thought, then what we can do is, if you do that with quantitative spectroscopy, you can get a luminosity. And you can do this for stars in the Hubble flow, and you can get luminosities and therefore distances. Yeah?
I'm sorry. Back with the H alpha, you get the density there, but doesn't that assume a radius at which the line is formed?
Yeah, that is then included in the modeling.
Okay.
I mean, you need to also model the continuum, and basically it's a radius.
Yeah. Okay, so photospheric radius? Or?
Yeah, okay. And there's tricks associated. Well, the photosphere, in these kind of cases, the photosphere is pretty well known. For an O star, your photosphere is at 2/3, and it's not very extended and so. So here, there's not that many issues with that. The point I want to make here is that the nice thing about this is that the mass cancel. Yeah? So you get something that only depends on luminosity. And we can plot these theoretical wind momenta as well, and we can compare them to these empirical ones. And what we find is that there is a discrepancy. So this is the theoretical one, and these are the observational ones. Or they're not really observational. Yes, they're based on H alpha, but then there is a complex non-LTE code, and then you get a nice relation. And they do, the nice thing is, they have the same slope. You can also use this to get empirical dependencies on this metallicity dependence, like Mokin has done that, and from the shift between the galaxy, the LMC and the SMC, you can get a slope that's very similar to that. But what about this general case? Forget about the metallicity dependence. Why is there this offset? Now, this has all been determined for unclumped winds, whereas in reality, the winds are clumped. And that means that the empirical mass rate has been overestimated by a factor, because this is a density squared dependence, the mass loss rate needs to be reduced, the empirical mass loss rate needs to be reduced by a factor 10 in terms of clumping factor. So the mass loss rate then goes down with a square root of 10, so that's about 3. Now,
it might be helpful if you just wrote down what the definitions of clumping factors. I mean, I know you and I know it, but
the clumping factor is the density squared.
The average of the density squared.
Okay.
No, inside. There you go. The top one is inside the...
Yeah, the top one is inside, and the other one is outside. So, and
the same D, by the way, is the other one. So
sorry?
There's a different symbol. That's not the
same. Oh, there's not this D.
It's called F clump or something.
F clump. Thinking about it, the way I always think about it is like the inverse of that is the volume filling factor. If you have a column of gas, and you're looking at it from here, so instead of having the whole volume filled up, you say only if 10% filled up and 90% is now void, then you have a clumping factor or a volume filling factor of 0.1. So the clumping factor is 10. It's 1 over 0.1, so 10. Now, I'm not going to talk about porosity. So the point is, you can have different, instead of having it like this, you could also have, say, half of that here and then half of that there. We'll have the same volume filling factor, so the same clumping factor. But for this situation, the photons have a larger porosity length to escape through than a situation like that. So that is where this other parameter comes in. It's no longer just the clumping factor, but also the porosity. In any case, what I said here, that the empirical rates come down by factor 3, that is under the assumption that the theory is right. Yeah, that doesn't have to be the case, of course. It is just the case, depending on what causes the clumping, if the clumping is caused, for instance, by the line, the LDI, the shadowing instability that Stan talked about, then you would expect all kinds of shocks and density fluctuations, but the time averaged velocity law and the time averaged mass loss rate is not affected. So what will be affected if you have these kind of things, of course, is now you have more stuff here and less stuff there, that will affect the empirical, it will affect these kind of things, but it will not affect the driving, to first order at least. But this is a bit of an unsatisfactory situation that we have this situation where the empirical mass loss rates need to be reduced due to clumping, but in order to fit theory. That is not the way you want to do science. You want to do it from first principles. So is there no hope of doing this any better? Actually, there is, and that is what I am very interested in, is the fact that this is for normal O stars. But when we go up and up and up to more luminous, more massive, very massive stars, then actually this starts to kink upwards. And this has already been talked about by Stan during the conference.
So hold on, before you get there, people also derive a clumping factor, though, just from observations, looking at electron scattering wings,
yes,
the line core, and P-Cygni profiles, because some depend on density, density squared.
Yes,
and that's not just that you're trying to match the.
No, sure. Actually, it's kind of the interesting thing in Wolf Rayet winds. You have a recombination core, so that goes with the density squared, and then you have electron scattering wings that go with density linearly. So from the mismatch, if you have an unclumped model, from the mismatch between the core and the wings, you get an idea about how much clumping there is. And people have done this kind of thing, And the clumping factor they derive is somewhere between 4 and 10. From over A stars, you can do that because you have these kind of very nice, strong emission lines with these electron scattering rings. For normal O stars, unfortunately, we cannot really do that. Then we have to rely on the UV. But if we rely on the UV, then we have the problems with the ionization and the porosity. So that is why we don't have any direct clumping factor information from the O star range. But we do have it from the Wolf-Rayet range.
There is, however, for the few stars, there are a few O stars that have good X-ray spectra. And the X-ray spectra can be used to, that's due to boundary absorption, which is a limit because it's a single density process. And those all give you a lower mass loss rate than what you get with the H-alpha.
Yeah, there are other issues, again, with the X-rays.
There's papers by Dave Cohen.
Yeah. So there's also a debate in the X-ray community surrounding these kind of issues between the Cohen group and the Potsdam group, basically. There's issues there. You can either do it with porosity or low mass loss rate and so on. But I think it's all not very clear at this point what the state is.
I disagree. I think it's very clear. But
I think
the point is that the clumping that you get from the line-driven instability is very, very small scale. Yes. And so it won't be spatially porous at all. Perfect. So it doesn't affect boundary absorption of X-rays. Perfect. And so that's a very good diagnostic for mass loss rate.
Yeah, but not for clumping. We were talking about the clumping factor.
Well, the clumping factor, the point is that you get the mass loss rates from X-ray line profiles because they're a linear process. If you don't think about them as being optically thick clumps, which is what the Potsdam group is trying to claim, you think about the fact that they're very small scale. The line shining this building makes them very small scale. Then you get, that's a very good clean diagnostic for a linear diagnostic for mass loss rate. Anyway,
there are other ways of getting mass loss rates, X-rays. Ultimately, we need to do the whole electromagnetic spectrum from X-rays, UV, optical, etc. And hopefully we will, by doing that model for not just one star, this has been done for one star by the Potsdam group, but we'll see what happens when a large sample of stars has been done, what the outcome is. But it is interesting, you mentioned, I was talking about the clumping factor, and you mentioned the mass loss rate. And I think that is another confusion in the community, is often that when there is a discrepancy between mass loss rates, people jump immediately to clumping. But there can be other reasons for discrepancies. One is, and I didn't talk about it here, but actually at a luminosity of about 5.2, if you go below that, the mass loss rates from observation seem to be much lower. And also from the theory, we actually find it very hard to drive a wind from first principles below this luminosity. And this is called the weak wind problem. So that is another completely different regime. The way I sort of look at this in terms of, I'm just talking about O stars. So we're on the main sequence. At about 30 solar masses, you have a speckle type 06.5. Below this, we are in the weak wind regime. And at the moment, we don't know very well what is going on there. It could be that the theoretical rates are correct, or more or less correct, because we do see evidence for winds in that regime, even though we can't drive anything. But the uncertainties are quite large. But that has probably little to do with clumping. It's something else. Maybe it's something to do with anything, really. Something to do probably below the sonic point that we don't have enough force to drive a wind. Then we have the more sort of regime between, say, 30 and 80, where this kind of plot applies. And then we have something that applies above 80. We get in the regime of the very massive stars. Yeah, and that is what I want to mention now. At this point, this inference that the clumping factor is about 10 and that the mass rate would go down by factor 3 is completely loose. It is not anchored in any way. But using that kink, we can actually get a constraint on the absolute mass loss rate. And the way to do that is to, you can show analytically that the M dot V infinity at that kink is basically L over C times the optical depth in the wind. So here we have your normal O star winds. They have optical depth less than 1, and then you go to WNH stars, and they are nitrogen rich and they are hydrogen rich. These are not classical Wolf-Rayet stars. They're not evolved. They're not helium core burning. They are Wolf-Rayet stars because they have extraordinary high Maslow's rates because of their extraordinary high luminosities. Yeah. So they are very massive stars. So they can be up to 300 solar masses. But at this point, at this kink, there has to be a point. You can show that there has to be a point where this kink occurs. And what we can we've done from Monte Carlo calculations is that this slope in M dot for the O stars, so M dot versus this stellar parameter gamma E, this goes with gamma E to the power 2, and here it goes with gamma E to the power 5. And this has been shown in models. Also, we've done this with the VFTS flames survey, Bestmann-Lehner 14, that these kind of slopes are different for the O-star regime and the Wolf-Rayet regime. So, but this is very nice that you can actually write down an equation like that, because at this point, this needs to be 1. Tau equals 1. So, if you can identify, if you have a large set of observations, like in the Tarantula Nebula, where you have O stars and Wolf-Rayet stars all the way up to 300 solar masses, you have a nice coverage of that whole upper main sequence, and you can write down that your mass loss rate equals the luminosity divided by C V infinity, just from simple considerations of the momentum. Now, why is this so powerful? C is known, V infinity you get from the P Cygni. So if you can determine your luminosity from non-dot E modeling, you immediately know what M dot is at that point, independent of any clumping or porosity. And that suddenly means that all the uncertainties in mass loss rates, which were like a factor 10 a while ago, because we didn't know whether this phosphorus 5 problem in the UV was real or not, we had an uncertainty that was quite high. But now, at this anchor point, it all depends on how accurate your luminosities are. And the luminosity is not very accurate, but the effective temperature is probably accurate at least within 10%. So the luminosity goes with T effective to the power 4, so at least 40%. That is for this exercise is very, very, very relevant, I think. So it's accurate. It's not precise. It could be slightly different, but it's very accurate. So someone said, I think it was Mathieu in his paper, that the eta factor is a free parameter. but it's not, and you cannot derive it from first principles. But I think, actually, of all the uncertainties in stellar evolution, this is the one thing that is extremely accurate. So at this point, you have an analytical formula that is exact. So we've anchored this point very accurately. Now, what happens in the regime here, because of the weak wind problem and so on, that is a different matter. Yeah?
Where is the kink then?
Where? Here. You mean the value?
Yeah, a number, yeah.
It's about 0.5. But the exact point we need to still work on.
And the luminosity value?
The luminosity for the VFTS, the luminosity is about 6. I think it's 6.1.
You didn't tell us how you derived this equation. So what goes into this?
This is the momentum equation. This one? This is the momentum equation in integral form. So basically, you really want to do it, you need to you really need to find your let me see. So you get your grad dr integral, and because grad, and then you need to do your, you basically come, I'm not going to derive the whole thing because that will take an hour or so, but you basically get to phi infinity plus phi escape squared divided by 2. And your grad is your g times your Eddington factor. So if you just write that out, you can, basically, this is the amount of radius acceleration you need to overcome both your potential energy and your kinetic energy.
Does all the opacity?
All the opacity is included in this.
Yeah. So how well is that understood?
Well, you can write this down analytically, and it doesn't depend on any opacity.
If it helps, in my talk and from the conference, there's a slide that basically derives this in a couple of steps.
Yeah.
So,
there's some assumptions there.
I can get it up, or I can rederive it if you want. But it basically comes from integrating the equation of motion, multiplying the VdVdr equation, which basically has the...
It's basically just this.
...driving at gravity.
You're basically...
Multiplying times density. Basically, you multiply that times density, and it's 4 pi r squared, and then you integrate... And you get basically this.
Yeah, but all the problem is in the derivative.
I'm not going to derive that whole thing, but what I can say, there is, if you do this exact, there's a correction factor here, F. Huh? Now, this F depends on gamma. And that F basically is gamma, I think it's something like that, is that right? It's 1 minus gamma, I think.
It's completely dependent on any porosity. Whatsoever.
Yes. Yeah. That doesn't. The point is that you can show that phi infinity squared is phi escape squared times 1 minus gamma. This is the full gamma.
Yeah, the other way around. Gamma minus 1.
But then, because, and this is the point, the you can, just for illustration purposes, phi infinity of V escape is alpha 1 over alpha. You can actually write, so that, is that right? Yeah, so gamma minus 1 must be alpha 1 over alpha, is that right?
Yeah, but I'm not sure that's the best way to go about it.
But if alpha is about 2...
Hopefully straightforward, if you just think about it from the point of view of tau as being this ability for photons to multiple scatter, an optical depth is the number of mean true paths you have to go in order to get from one place to another. And if you think about it from the point of view of something, that tau is like the number of times you have to scatter and get out of the stellar wind, then it all works out that intuitivism is exactly what the nature of the opacity is. It's an ability for the radiation to be coupled to the gas, which depends on this optical depth.
That is correct.
And that basically gives you this relation that you're put down.
So gamma is
modified by a factor.
So you can show that this is, so you can put this plus 1, and then so that's alpha is 1 over 1 minus alpha. The point is that alpha is 2/3.
It all starts.
Sorry?
It all starts.
Yes. Yeah, these are O-stars. O-stars are steroids or whatever. But I'll come to your point. I just want to see if this is correct. Anyway, you can... Well, I had it right the first time. It's gamma minus 1 over gamma.
But gamma now is the total gamma.
It's total gamma.
Yes.
Not just electron scattering. So this is a couple factor of a few or so. Anyway, you can show that this is 0.6. Huh?
6.
Well, if you want to, this is point. This is 2/3, so this is a third. So this is 3. 3 minus 1 over 3. You get about 0.6. Anyway, you can do this exactly. Yeah? Now, the question then is, how good are those gammas and how good are those models? Yeah? Because we've tested this for different models. We used Potsdam models, CMFGEN models, all kinds of models. And you can derive this from the models. Yeah? And you get about 0.6. Then we have done the same with just beta models. In a reasonable range of observed infinity over escapes, and you can work out what your varying your phi infinity of your escape, your beta laws, and phi infinity is pretty well known from observations. You can still find that this 0.6 is very, very accurate, and the uncertainty in this is far less than the uncertainty in that luminosity that I wrote down earlier. So the uncertainty in this correction factor is half of the uncertainty in luminosity determination. So, I cannot see any way that is not a strong analytical accuracy. Not precision, but accuracy. No? So I think in the high mass range, I think we are pretty clear. Now the question is, what happens off the main sequence?
How does a tidal force change that statement, Jody?
How does a tidal force?
In your momentum equation?
Doing
O star, so.
You mean like an additional wave driven? Well, I'm sure you can write other acceleration terms, and you will get different answers. A magnetic field or yeah.
I guess maybe a similar question is, it's a spherically symmetric equation, so yeah. Star can be rotating.
Sure.
So how, there is some uncertainty with that.
Yes, there is, yeah. If you want to do this precise, then yes, I think you're going to have problems. But even rotation, you have to be very close to critical to really get big effects of rotation on the mass loss rate. If you look at the observed, the fact that these things observationally follow such nice relations suggests that these second order effects, like some variations. I mean, the terminal velocity is not exactly the same exactly every time for every speckle type. So probably some of that variation is due to these additional effects, such as rotation. But it's not going to be the dominant one.
Yeah, and the second question, the tau, when it's sort of bigger than 1, where do you stop the integration, or what's the integration range for the tau?
You go from the sonic point out.
Okay, from sonic.
So, from me to you, basically, if I'm the sonic point. Yes. Okay, so, I mentioned those bistability jumps, but the interesting thing is that stars encounter these in two ways, basically. One is during their actual evolution, and the other point is that they can do that during the LBV phase. So, a lot of people, when they hear LBV, they think eta car, and that is not the full story. Eta car is probably an LBV, but what is an LBV? So LBVs, the general population are the S-door variables. Yeah? And there are 20, 30 of them or so known in the HRD. And they may or may not lie on this S-door instability strip. The point is that during timescales of about 10 years, they go back and forth. And the visual magnitude goes up by about 2 magnitudes or so, generally. That is what is kind of characteristic for the LBVs as a class. They are also short-term variations, and some of them have clearly gone through giant eruptions, like Eta Car, P Cygni perhaps, AG Car has a huge nebula. So it is well possible that these two are related, the Eta Car type outburst and the S-door variations, but exactly how, I don't think anyone really knows. So what causes these? One of the points I want to get at is we have all this stuff for line-driven winds and O-stars. Then we have ideas about what happens maybe with type 2 and supernova, and that there has to be a huge giant eruption. But there are things happening in between. We have physics that changes from your normal CAK into a regime where you get closer to the Eddington limit. And we have physics that if you go from your O stars, you hit this bistability jump. These are much more gradual type of physics things, and I think there's a lot of insight to be gained from that. That may then also play a role for these more extreme cases of Eta Car type outbursts or other types of supernova. So I think the two important things for LBVs is, one is that they encounter this bistability jump. So now I'm not suggesting that is the cause of the S-Doradus variations, but the other thing is that it goes close to the Eddington limit. And it is probably getting close to the Eddington limit that inflates the stellar envelope. Now, I don't think we should talk about envelope inflation, because that will be another discussion. I think we should do that maybe tomorrow. Sam?
Maybe some tomorrow if we get time, but maybe.
But the point is, there is a mechanism that we have that can get a star from the hot to the cool by having an envelope inflation when you get closer to the Eddington limit. Then the question is, what happens? If you cross this bistability jump, we may have a situation, so you get to the Eddington limit, your radius goes up. Yeah. And as a result of that, you cross the bistability jump, so the Maslow's rate goes up. Yeah. And that means, if you increase it enough, you might have a way to remove that envelope mass, and then you've lost it, so you go back to where you were before, with a lower radius and a lower Maslow's rate. So you could envision some sort of cycle where the stars cycle through this. Envelope inflation, higher Maslow's rate, going back and forth. Now, this is not a full proof of this, but I suspect that this is the key to understanding these variations. And I would hope that kind of discussion is something we can have where we combine the two, where we look at the structure in terms of envelope inflation, and where we look at what happens to the Maslow's rate. So that is sort of a point of discussion.
I think that's a change from the past. There was the old idea that an increase in the Maslow's rate created a pseudo-photosphere, which made the star look cooler. But instead, now it's looking more like the envelope inflates, and maybe crossing the bistability jump triggers a slightly higher Maslow's rate. It's not high enough to drive the pseudo-photosphere. So that's something that has definitely changed about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now,
in some sense, it's just the opposite. The higher mass loss rate lets the balloon out, and then it goes back to the hot state.
Yes. Now, I don't want to... Norbert.
Well, I just want to say we have looked into this a little bit in more detail, and the problem is that one still needs to find a way to make this unstable. Because if you have just dependencies of mass loss rate with temperature, as you draw on the blackboard over there with your bistability, the star may just still settle down at one point and find its equilibrium situation. So one still needs to
make in this,
it unstable in any way.
The in this paper with Goetz, we have this W parameter, this instability parameter. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but so you have this opacity bump. There might be a second one here, but basically you have you're at the gas plane, and
yes, I'm going down.
he writes going up to the left.
So basically, you have a high both. This is your center on the star. You want to go that way, but you encounter the opacity bump. If convection can solve your problem, you might still go straight through it. But if not, you have to go all around the opacity bump. And the way to think about it is that this is basically like a density. So this is like your minimum density. Here you have your bump. It's like at a temperature of 150,000, 200,000 Kelvin. But if you want to go around that bump, you need to go to very low density, but you still need to reach a certain optical depth to get this bump here. So the only way to do that is to have a very large radius inflation. Now, you can write an analytic formula for that radius inflation, R out over R in terms of this W parameter, where this W parameter is the width of this iron opacity bump divided by the mean density divided by the potential energy. So if this W gets close to 1, then this goes to infinity and you have an instability. So in terms of finding this instability, maybe this is of use.
Didn't happen in our models, all I can say.
I think the reason that allows you to have basically inflation go to arbitrary things. But the reason, as you say, is it doesn't typically end up being that dramatic, is because convection does always moderate how low density you go to.
Yeah.
So do the nice thing is if you ignore convection, then this rho mean that you have, which is really just half of rho min, one over the inverse. But the point is that it can be derived just from the opacity tables, from the opal tables. And it's a very strong function of how close you are to the exponent. Once you get to gamma of order a half or so, that W approaches 1 and the star inflates to arbitrarily large size. But in reality, what's happening is that convection will reduce that. Unless you're in something like the Wolff-Rayet
model. Yes. So for the LBVs, maybe there are ways that these models from Norbert, they show you only go, or maybe you go slightly through it, I don't know. But in the Wolff-Rayet case, you might not be convective. So for the LBVs, I think we have something that looks like the star wants to inflate, just like the models want to inflate, the stars want to inflate. So I think this is the key to the Esdarades variations. But anyway, that.
So I think Nathan at this point should comment on his observational constraints on Esdarades.
Yeah, I mean the LBVs that show the Esdarades variability are the ones that are out in the middle of nowhere and not in clusters. And so if there's a way to inhibit this instability in most stars, that's actually good. Because it's only, for some reason, it's only stars that are overluminous compared to the ones around them that actually show the Esdarades variation. So something has to keep this from turning on in a normal single star.
The early case beam emergence was slightly above the main sequence rate. It would be slightly more luminous and cooler than mass. So maybe that the envelopes are just sufficiently different because they're closer to the stability jump or something.
But the point is that a 60 solar mass star that evolves to an OS star off the main sequence gets a stronger wind, and its luminosity goes up, and it goes into the regime of the HR diagram where the LBVs are, and it's maybe sitting on the Esdarades instability strip. It doesn't show the LBV very
well. I think for these lower mass stars, these stars, they don't lose that much mass on the main sequence. Mass loss on the main sequence might still be important for angular momentum loss, even without a magnetic field. And Mathieu and Selma said that even here, uncertainties in the mass loss rate might actually have changes in the core, if I'm understanding correctly. But other than that, there's not much happening in terms of mass loss here. But when you go here, you lose a lot of mass in the red supergiant phase. And then, if you have a high mass loss rate here, probably also to do with a high gamma, I'm not sure, but LBVs here, and this is what the models in Geneva and so show, they can have quite a high L over M. So I'm not saying that this has to be single stars, but I'm saying single stars might do it if you lose enough mass.
It's very hard for those to be two ends, because the Geneva models that end up there have almost no hydrogen number left, right, at the time they explode.
Sure.
I don't think we're trying to make two ends out of this.
No.
Two ends are more for giant.
I'm just talking about LBVs. Let's not talk about a supernova here. The point is, LBVs are close to the Eddington limit. Now, the question is, why? Many of them are isolated. That is a hint that many of them may have gone through mergers or Higgs. That's basically Naden's point. And all I'm saying is, I have nothing against that, but there might also be single ways of doing that. That's all I'm saying. But I think rotation plays a key in this, because a subset of the S-dwarf variations, José Gros has shown, rotates quite rapidly. So that means that... And the interesting thing is that if you plot phi sin I versus T effective for normal B supergiants, so here's the bistability jump, for O stars, so this temperature goes that way now.
You're disappearing.
You're being occulted. Eclipse.
Maybe I should be more porous.
Come over here.
What did I say? T effective goes that way. So the V sin I, if you look at O stars, you have a whole range. You have fast rotators, you have slow rotators. The B supergiants are all slow rotators. Now we have had a discussion about why that is. Maybe they're braked by bistability jump. Maybe they are a special evolution. Maybe they're normal post-red supergiants. Maybe they're binary products. But then the question is why they're slow rotators. But the LBVs do stand out. They do rotate. Or at least a subset of them have high phi sin I. So something seems to be going on with them. And why they have this higher phi sin I, maybe they're mergers. Who knows? But I think we need to decouple the question of the LBV instability from how it got there.
Well,
put it differently. Of course, they need to talk to each other, but I think it's a bit risky to immediately jump to a stellar evolutionary model that gets as close to a certain gamma, and then we say, okay, now we understand the problem. The real problem for me is still, how do we get S-Doradus variations?
What are the actual values of Vsin I?
Sorry? Oh, for about 200. For HECAR, I think it's about 200, HRCAR as well. And that is actually a significant fraction of breakup.
This divide between the scattering of very large rotation then to slow rotate,
yeah.
That's at the bistability temperature.
That happens at the bistability temperature.
Now,
21,000 Kelvin.
21.
Yeah. Now, whether that is due to that bistability jump, that still remains. Sure. I think the possibility is that way. But if you do accept that that would be due to bistability breaking, it would mean that these are still main sequence stars. So that would then mean that you need a very large overshooting parameter or something else in the models that mixes a lot of material and extends you really need to go all the way like that, where the bistability jump must be on this side of that hook.
Or have to be helium core burning, maybe.
Or yeah, that could be helium core burning. Yes. They cannot be explained from just post-main sequence.
By which I mean helium core.
They cannot be in the Hadron gap, because there would not be that many of them. That's the point. So either they are post-red supergiants, have lost the angular momentum, they're now core helium burning in the blue, either single or binary scenario, or they're still main sequence stars. If they are still main sequence stars, they must have a huge overshooting product. Yeah.
How much overshooting do you need for that?
At least 0.335, but probably even more, so 0.4, 0.5. In terms of the pressure skill height of overshooting. But that's not the number we know.
Corny doesn't look
impressed. Well, there are some stars that have that, right?
Yeah.
At least, looks like it. So it's huge, but it's not necessarily wrong.
Nathan, could you repeat what you said again? The LBV stars, all the ones that just have the normal outburst, they are found alone? And the ones that there's other normal stars that are in that position but aren't outbursting and they're found with other stars, or they're found in binaries, or
there are stars in the same part of the HR diagram in young clusters. And okay. They don't show the Esterházy instability.
They're in young clusters though.
But all of the LBVs that show the variability are overluminous compared to the stars around them.
Right. In the young cluster, though, are they old enough to have started helium burning?
Well, we don't know the ages of the. I would think we don't know the ages of the young clusters because they're derived from single star turnons, but they have loose drag or something. So their ages might be older than we think.
But maybe those stars are too young to have gotten to the LBV phase yet.
Well, no. I mean,
if
they're 60 or 80 solar mass stars, they all have basically the same lifetime. They all live for 2.5 or 3 million. And then they move off the main sequence. So they're old enough that they've moved off the main sequence. They just don't show the variability. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Do you want
to? Yeah. My talk is very different from all this. This is a very fundamental talk, and it's a fantastic talk. I liked it very, very much. Great talk. Thank you very much. What I would like to talk about is a slightly different problem. But maybe first there should still be discussion of your...
Do people want to continue discussing this, or do we switch to Ed has a 20-minute presentation on some O-star binaries, I think?
Supergiant X-ray binaries, which also have winds, and there is a problem with these winds because it seems that the wind velocities are much lower than what one seems to get from these theories here. That's basically, it's a problem, and I would like just to present this problem, and maybe people can come up with solutions of this problem.
Well, we'll talk some more about winds and LBVs tomorrow.
Yeah.
Also, Joyce will be talking a little bit about her calculations and also doing some stuff. So maybe it's a good time now to switch to yours.
Yeah,
but I can take
a break. I would like to.
Yeah,
can I ask a question? At the start, you talked about 2013 CU.
Ah, yes.
You said you were going to explain that.
No, I said I want to know what is going on there.
So, okay, do you have any explanation?
So, well, my point is, okay, yes, it's good that you remind me. The now it's probably gone. If you look at the stellar models of the Geneva group, in the last 1,000 years or so, the gamma E increases towards explosion. So this is for O-star or O-stars on steroid type things, but something like an enhanced mass loss rate like that, it doesn't have to be existing only for, say, line-driven winds. So when I talk about an enhanced mass loss rate, I don't necessarily mean Itakar. I just mean a mass rate that is suddenly much higher, an enhancement. So if we, this kind of enhanced mass loss close to the Eddington limit might also happen in supernovae progenitors just before explosion.
Why would it happen just before explosion?
Well, in the last 1,000 years or so. Well, because of changes in the structure of the star, I don't know why exactly the gamma E increases, but it increases. Well, partly because of the luminosity. Well, the mass drops. Because you have a mass loss, the mass drops. So the
It may also be in that case, in the 2Bs, the progenitors may be yellow or red supergiants that have very low mass and inflated envelopes. And wind speeds might be slower, and the mass loss rates might come down a little bit compared to what Avishai's paper had. Because of the wind speed. But they're still high. But it could be because the star has such low mass that you get this sort of inflated, you know, like a wind that is kind of puffy, but not expanding very fast in the last 1,000 years of the star's life or something. The ones we've actually detected and put on the HR diagram are yellow supergiants, and they're not superluminous.
Yeah. It sounds like you need really high mass loss rates, but at the same time, you need to fine-tune it so that there's just a little bit of hydrogen left. I don't know how you reconcile those two pictures.
This issue of the little bit of hydrogen that you mean because of the 2B.
Yeah,
I heard this argument before. I don't know enough about this IMF argument and the gap between the 2Bs.
It's a very short time when it could have very little tiny.
Yeah, I mean, if you really have these large mass loss rates, then if you only have a little hydrogen left, you should blow that off really quick. So in order to time everything so you just have a little hydrogen left and a large mass loss
What I'm trying to hint at is that, yes, it had lost just the right amount, but if it had lost a little bit less, it wouldn't have been a 2B. It would have been a 2P. If it had lost a little bit more, it would not have been a 2B. It would have been a 1B.
Sure.
So just the fact that the 2Bs have only a limited amount of hydrogen, that to me is not really, that doesn't mean that much to me, because then you're just looking at the one object instead of looking at the whole population.
Sure. Yeah. Then
so it's not, I don't think it's a fine-tuning argument.
Actually,
that way.
They're fairly common. I mean, they're not.
Sure.
So.
And if this really works out or not, and in terms of how you can get this whole continuum, I don't know. But I think to say just for the one object that is fine-tuning, I'm not so convinced about that.
They're about 10% of quark collapse supernovae, and they all have sort of a tenth of solar mass, hydrogen or less.
Right.
And then you move to the type 2Ps, and they don't have 0.5 solar masses. They have many solar masses. So it's like an either-or in terms of the envelope mass. They don't have 5 or 10 solar masses, or they have 0.1 in terms of the light curves.
I mean, the idea is that they come from two different populations.
Right.
You have the 2Ps come from single stars, perhaps mergers, I don't know. And the 2Bs come from binaries. So they
really
lose the hydrogen envelope because of mass transfer. But once mass transfer is over, the actual stellar wind mass loss rate is really small. So the star has a very hard time getting rid of the final 0.1 or 0.2 solar mass of the hydrogen. I mean, the mass rate is like 10 to the minus 7 solar mass per year or something. I mean, it's unclear because these helium cores are very low mass and we don't really know them.
I mean, I don't understand why we are able to then model this spectrum with a single, with a steady 1D smooth wind with a mass rate of 10 to the minus 3 solar mass per year, where we can get the electron scattering wings and the core nicely fitted.
The line core is unresolved.
It is, yes.
The spectra. So if you had all that mass, it's sort of a 0.1 solar mass disk or unstar, and it was very dense and had electron scattering wings, when it gets photoionized by the shock breakout, you wouldn't know the difference. The spectrum would look the same because you have the unresolved line core and then these broad electron scattering wings. So it doesn't, you know, just because a 1D spherical wind model can fit the spectrum doesn't mean it's a spherical wind.
But
because we're not actually getting the output.
But wouldn't, if this was a binary, wouldn't you expect a large-scale asymmetry in the system?
There may be.
Yeah. The point is, whether you have either a small-scale or a large-scale asymmetry in the system, it doesn't really matter for the difference between these electron scattering wings and these line cores. The fact that we can fit them both doesn't just suggest a smooth wind on small-scale, but it suggests that the whole thing is smooth. So I find that hard to imagine with a binary. But
why does that tell you about this? That it's a spherical wind and not a disk or something.
If it was a disk, you basically get the same kind of thing as you have over there with the column. You basically start to have clumping factors.
Sure, that's just the ratio you can. I mean, we don't know what the clumping factor is in a disk, maybe it's zero and it takes up 1/10 of the total volume because it's a small opening angle. Because they do, when you look at these, the type 2Bs at late times, they often show these double horn profiles in the nebular phase, which suggests that there's a torus of some kind that's left. So there, I think there, and there is some polarization that suggests that they're asymmetric as well. So it's possible that they are asymmetric.
Well, I think that is something to find out whether that can be done. This happens to be a 2B. It will be interesting to see once there's more and more flash spectroscopy of all these different types of supernova, 2Ps maybe, or
there are a few 2Ps.
Yeah, and once it's no longer individual objects, but you start to get populations of these things, I think it will become much easier to see what's happening and whether you have a continuum or you have two populations. Right? Ed.
Okay. I think you should give him an applause. I'll have to connect. I hope this works. How does this work?
What I would like to talk about is a problem that has been on my mind for some time, and that has to do with the fact that in supergiant high-mass X-ray binaries, we think they are, the accretion is just by capturing stellar wind matter, and so you can use these neutron stars as probe of the stellar wind and get information which you otherwise might not be easily able to get. Now, it turns out that in the supergiant, in many of the supergiant systems, the winds seem much slower than we would have expected from theory. Now, the standard supergiant stellar high mass X-ray binaries, the idea is that the companion star is still inside the Roche lobe. You have stellar wind, and just by Bondi-Hoyle accretion, the neutron star captures some of that wind matter. And a very good example of a system where that seems to work is Vela X1. It has an orbital period of about 9 days, rather massive neutron star, 1.88. and the supergiant, it's an eclipsing binary, so you can determine the masses fairly well. The supergiant is about 23 solar masses. Spin period is typical, like it is for the supergiant high mass X-ray binaries. It's a long spin period. And in the ultraviolet, from ultraviolet observations, you find that the terminal wind velocity is 1500, like you would expect for such a supergiant. And probably due to the whole accretion process, there is also in the orbital plane evidence for cool expanding matter with a lower velocity, but that may be due to this photoionization wake, which you also get. The idea is that this neutron star, by Bondi-Hoyle accretion, captures this wind matter. The X-rays do ionize a part of the wind, and when it is highly ionized, the ions that drive the wind cannot keep driving the wind, and as a result, there is when this neutron star is passing, it forms also a wake behind it where the matter is recombining again, and this is this dense, what they call a photoionization wake. It's due to the recombination, actually. This is a picture which I got from John Wilms. Actually, it turns out that this wake is more, it's further down, as I will show in the next slide.
I'm already confused by something, because it's 1,500 kilometers per second, so it's really fast for a supergiant.
This is what one sees from the
neutron. It's a disk wind, maybe.
Yes. It is the spin of the neutron stars, I guess.
What?
The pace spin, 283 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, this is the spin period.
The neutron stars.
Yes. Of the neutron star. Yeah. Sure.
But the terminal.
This is from the ultraviolet P Cygni profiles.
But it's not the wind of the B supergiant, right? It's like a disk wind or something. That seems fast.
That's not so fast. No, that's quite reasonable.
That it seems to be normal for a B0 supergiant.
No, you're on the hot side of the bicycle jump here. Mm-hmm. So you just have the fact that the escape velocity is a little bit lower than the star. That's why instead of 2,000, you get 1,500.
Now this is a normal system and it is not obscure. The Felix one is up to 2002, we knew about only six of such systems in our galaxy. And then in 2002 was launched a gamma-ray satellite, the European, together with Russia, Integral, which was not meant to study X-ray binaries or something like that. It was mainly for doing gamma-ray spectroscopy and gamma-ray imaging in the 15 keV to 10 MeV range. And it's a very sensitive satellite. It's a huge thing, 2 tons. It is basically the same structure as XMM. It has the same bus, but on top of that bus is built this gamma ray telescopes, the gamma ray spectrometer, and the imager. They have coded mask imaging, and so they have a large field of view. And surprisingly, it turned out that they found lots of new supergiant high mass X-ray binaries, which had never been seen by the other X-ray observatories, which always worked at lower energies, mostly below 10 keV. Things like also Chandra works, of course, in the soft X-ray regime. Now, if you have absorption, if you have a large column density then of hydrogen, then the soft X-rays are absorbed and you don't see the object. And above 15 keV, the hard X-rays are not absorbed. And so suddenly we got 4 times more of the supergiant systems. And since that time also, Swift has discovered a couple, because Swift also works at higher energies. But so integral quadrupled the number of supergiant Feynman's X-ray bindings. But the fact is that in the softer X-rays, you don't see them. They come only out in the higher energies, and that means that they are obscured for some reason or another. There's a lot of material in the line of sight to these systems, and that material happens to be in the system. It's not the interstellar absorption, it is in the systems themselves. Now, in X-ray binaries, a very much used diagram is this Corbett diagram, where you plot the pulse period of the neutron star against the orbital period. And the supergiant systems are typically in the top left of the diagram. These are the squares. So they, almost all of them have these very long spin periods. There's one even above 10 to the 4 seconds. And Vela X1, as I showed, that's somewhere around here. It has about 300 seconds. But the supergiant systems are in this part. Integral also discovered another type of supergiant systems. These are these triangles. They show enormous flares, which last less than an hour, where they go up to the Eddington limit, and then they turn off completely again. We still don't know exactly what the reason of that is. But the obscured systems is the majority here of the sources. Yeah, the B-emission X-ray binaries are the blue triangles, open triangles. And yeah, there we know, of course, that there is a relation between the spin period and the orbital period. And they are by far the largest group. But you see that the supergiant systems in general have rather short orbital periods, not much above 10 days. Now, you can try to calculate how the wind accretion proceeds, and for one of these obscured systems, Blondin, together with the people in Geneva, Manoussakis and Walter, have done for this one integral system, which looks a lot like Vela X1, by the way, because the orbital period and spin period look quite the same, and it's also a B one half supergiant. You can do hydrodynamic calculations how this wind accretion goes in the system, and it turns out you must think of the neutron star sitting somewhere here, and this is done for different masses of the neutron star, and of course you have to put in a terminal velocity of the wind also in these calculations, and it turns out that you get this type of wake structures. This for a 1.5 solar mass neutron star, 1.7, 1.9, and 2.0. You see the wake getting much stronger when the mass of the neutron star increases. And now if you compare these calculations with the observations of the absorption in this system, as a function of orbital phase. It is an eclipsing system, so you don't see the source here. At phase one, the neutron star is behind the supergiant. And so here between 0.9 and 0.1, you don't see it because the system is eclipsed. But you see the X-ray intensity at the different phases here, and then they try to match this with these calculated wind absorption. And you see the column density of hydrogen is plotted here vertically. And what you see is that you have a kind of observed obscuration profile, and this is done for different neutron star masses, and it turns out that you must have a pretty massive neutron star in here, somewhere around 1.9 solar masses, to fit the observed curve. But the amazing thing is that the velocity of the wind that you need here, the terminal velocity, is only 500 kilometers a second. And that is the thing which I do not understand, because you would expect this B0, BN1/2 supergiant to have a wind terminal velocity of 1500. And what could be the reason that these velocities are so
low? So in all these calculated curves, there's a local maximum at phase of about like 0.5 or so.
Yeah.
But is that seen at all in the observations?
What?
Is that because the data points, if I see
yeah,
them.
Yeah, but you say there is missing a point somewhere here.
Yeah.
The observations are what they are.
Yeah. All right. Is there any hope to get to observe that maximum? Because
would be nice. I don't know.
I feel like it's a very strong prediction.
Well, you can see this going up. Question about where it peaks.
Yeah,
it would be nice to have.
Well, you're right, but indeed,
you reach a minimum of
it. It would be nice to have something around the peak. You're right.
Yeah.
And clearly, well, here it's coming out of eclipse, and the neutron star is here, and here, yeah, it is the stuff in front of the neutron star. If I go back to the other picture. It is the stuff in front which does a lot of the absorption for some reason or another. Here it goes into eclipse again. There's again a number of calculations. Sorry for the small letters. But the lowest is here for 650 kilometers a second. Terminal velocity, and the top ones are for 500 kilometers. So you cannot get very far from 500 kilometers per second. And so, but you're right, indeed, it would be nice to have had a point indeed at that part of the diagram. Anyhow, what the author said, and this is just from a press release, it's there. That's what John Bolland said. Simulations show that the winds, with slower winds, you get what you observe here. And also, you need a pretty massive neutron star to get the profile what you see here, and they get a 1.9 solar mass neutron star. But my big question is to the stellar wind people, how can you get a terminal velocity that low, and I have no clue why.
Can you go back two slides back, please?
I thought that perhaps this whole question of inflation, which you have, which Norbert has been working on, may completely. You mean this picture?
No, one more, please. Or this one. No, so I'm just wondering. A question to the wind people. Where would the terminal velocity be reached in with respect to the stellar radius?
They put in the calculations a terminal velocity, so they use a profile. They put the terminal velocity of 500 in there.
Yeah, I understand.
But instead of the wind?
I presume they take your type of profiles like
point,
you have.
Point at what radius would it be?
The radius, like a two-star radius, you're only half of the terminal velocity when you get to that point. If you have a beta one law.
So this is the terminal velocity is 500.
Right. But the point is that what they're sensitive to is the velocity at the radius of the neutron star. You can put
sure.
it in any velocity.
But so, but that velocity is lower, of course.
It's lower, but it could also be explained by having a slower acceleration. In other words, you might have my way of thinking about it would be that if you make these neutron stars very massive, there might be some feedback mechanism on the acceleration of the wind.
But that is included in all this. This ionization and all this stuff is included in these calculations.
I doubt, I don't know.
That means that the velocity of the wind at the neutron star radius is only like 200 kilometers per second.
I presume that.
So did they vary the terminal velocity?
What?
Did they vary?
They varied. That was in the picture.
I'm just wondering whether it's maybe degenerate with the mass of the neutron star in terms of the length of the wave and so on.
And the other thing is that Bondi-Hoyle accretion is very, very sensitive to the velocity at the location of the accretor, because it's a focusing of, you know, material. And
but they do the full hydro calculation.
But I'm saying it's a cross-section for absorption of for the accretion onto the neutron star goes like 1/4 of the
force. Yeah, sure.
And so there's a lot of feedback that can go on there.
Where did they show the variation? Where they varied the wind velocity? Can you show me that plot again?
Yeah, sorry, the letters are so small, but the...
So what are the values that they...
The lower one is here, 650, and the top one is 500, so that does not make that much of a difference, actually. They varied between 650 and 500, actually.
So if your question is, can these supergiants have slow winds, then the question is, the answer is yes.
Why?
Because we're close to the bicipability jump. So what I showed earlier, the stars to the hot side of the bicipability jump, they have high terminal velocities, obviously 2,000-3,000. Uh-huh. And I thought this was B0.5, so I'm expecting it's...
Yeah, actually they say it's B0.5, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were a B1. But on the other hand, there are a couple of these obscured systems which have O-type supergiants.
So the B1s, at B1 you flip. So you go from iron 4 to iron 3, and then suddenly the mass rate goes up, and the terminal velocity goes down.
Okay.
So the terminal velocity always goes down, because the escape velocity goes down. But here you go quite steeply down. So that's because of the change in the iron 4 to iron 3.
But then you would say this would only happen, say, if you have supergiants which are around B1 or
something. B1 or later. Yeah.
B1 or later. But as far as I know, a number of these obscured systems have O-type supergiants also. So.
Yeah, but maybe they don't show the same likers. I mean, you'd have to do.
Yeah, this one has been studied very well, and not all of them have been studied yet. Okay, but then the explanation would be that the supergiant has been a little bit misclassified. It could be a little bit later, just half a spectral type later than B.5. Okay. Maybe it's all that's all.
I just want to about the masses. So we have an eclipsing binary here. Aren't the masses of the stars known dynamically?
I have not seen the masses well determined for this system. The companion is rather faint. It's far away. And so...
B-supergiant is faint? What do you mean? We have a B-supergiant and a neutron star, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, Vela X1 is a 7th magnitude... The supergiant is nearby. It's a 7th magnitude star. And this is 10 or 11 or something like that. So I have not seen a good orbit for that one difference. Vela X1 is an easy one because it's a 7th magnitude star. So it's something that's easy. I've not seen that yet. But that's a good one.
Thanks.
Okay. That was what I wanted to say.